Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about Barack Obama's progressive mandate that he already appears to be shying away from. And certainly the Majority Leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, timidly remarked this week that this is not a mandate for a political party or an ideology. We'll be speaking with David Sirota, a political organizer and nationally syndicated newspaper columnist and best-selling author who has worked in state and national politics all over America. His columns run weekly in the Denver Post, San Francisco Chronicle, and the Seattle Times. And we'll be talking to him about his sense that Barack Obama does indeed have a progressive mandate. And then we'll talk about the aftermath of the election and the reduction of the Republican Party down to a southern redoubt. And we'll look into what our guest calls the Fourth Republic. Michael Lind is the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush, and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and What Lincoln Believed, his groundbreaking study of American grand strategy, the American Way of Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy, and the American Way of Life, was published in October 2006. And his new article published at Salon.com, Michael Lind suggests that Barack Obama may join Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt on a short list of American presidents who presided over the refounding of the United States and into what Michael Lind calls the Fourth Republic. And then we'll look into the possibility of a right-wing backlash to the election of Barack Obama. There have already been some arrests of white supremacists bent on assassinating the new president-elect. And we'll look into the righteous rage of the real Americans who Sarah Palin whipped up and to try and get a sense of their alienation. Let's now begin with the progressive agenda or mandate. A mandate without an agenda, I should say, that Barack Obama appears to have, yet he seems to be shying away from. David Sirota is a political organizer, nationally syndicated newspaper columnist, best-selling author. He's worked in state and national politics all over America. His columns run weekly in the Denver Post, San Francisco Chronicle, and the Seattle Times, as well as other newspapers. He's a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future and the founder of the Progressive States Network, both nonpartisan research institutions. His first book, Hostile Takeover, was a New York Times bestseller. His new book, widely acclaimed, is The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. And he has a new article urging Barack Obama to implement a progressive agenda for America. And based upon the people that showed up the other day at the president-elect's first press conference, David Sirota, they seem to be fairly weighed in terms of establishment figures. Not too many people, for example, representing labor, which has always been the base of the Democratic Party. I guess only a David Barnier, not that he represents labor, but at least he has sympathies to labor. So already out of the gate, and we had also the mayor of Los Angeles was there for whatever reasons, I'm not sure. What was your sense, David Sirota, of that the people lined up behind Barack Obama in his first press conference?
Well, I think Barack Obama is attuned to symbolism. And I think we can discern in a general sense that he believes that it's important for him to symbolically reassure the establishment of this country, the power structure of this country, that he's not going to rock the boat too much. Now, having said that, I don't necessarily want to presuppose that he won't rock the boat. In other words, this is a guy whose campaign platform was arguably the most progressive campaign platform we've seen in contemporary American history for a Democratic or Republican nominee, but who also stylistically came off as a rather moderate figure. So my take on Barack Obama's formula is, and this is an optimistic take, is that he believes that he can put a quote-unquote moderate face on a potentially very progressive agenda. We've seen this morning, just one example, you know, people have concerns that Rahm Emanuel, the Democratic Leadership Council affiliated guy, a former investment banker who is Obama's chief of staff, was on television this morning saying that that Obama is not going to push a NAFTA expansion, does not support a NAFTA expansion in the lame duck Congress, attaching it to a stimulus package. That is a departure for Emanuel himself, for his own sort of ideology. So that suggests to me, I think, that we can't prejudge Obama only on his personnel decisions. Certainly they're important, but I think we need to remember that even during the Great Depression, you know, FDR brought in a lot of advisors who previously were not all that progressive, and under the circumstances became much more progressive.
And how much is the economic crisis itself circumscribing any kind of agenda, whether it's progressive or centrist?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, we saw in the New York Times this weekend one of Obama's top economic advisors said that's the first thing that they have to deal with is basically this financial crisis. The argument is being made that because we're spending $700 billion on this crisis, it means that we can't go forward with other priorities like solving the healthcare situation, dealing with in a robust way economic stimulus or the energy crisis. That argument is being made by conservatives. It's being made by sort of establishment pundits. My sense is that Obama doesn't buy it, doesn't believe it, sees that these things are all intricately connected. That if you structure the bailout, if he doesn't come in and fix it, it will bring down his entire presidency, at least in terms of the economics of it. That if the bailout is allowed to continue the way it is, it doesn't stop with $700 billion. It puts the country on the hook for any future losses, and it could really, I think, bring down the economic part of his presidency. And I think he understands that.
Well, it's already brought David Sirota. It's already brought down a number of Republicans, ironically, who voted for that package. There's a lot of anger on the right, and the Democrats clearly carried President Bush and Secretary Paulson's water on this one. As far as we can tell, this $700 billion hasn't done very much at all. And now there's talk of these people on Wall Street using that money to take these huge bonuses.
Right.
It's not addressing Main Street. This is not a stimulus package to get people back to the malls, since our economy is two-thirds predicated upon consumption. Not that I approve of the notion of going back to the malls, but that's the reality of our economy. So it seems to me that unless very soon, and he's talking about a stimulus package, unless that stimulus package is redirected to the American people away from Wall Street, in fact, I think there's a big scandal brewing about the $700 billion.
Oh, I completely agree. And you saw in Obama's first radio address, as president-elect, I think it was the fifth or sixth paragraph, he actually said one of the top priorities is going to be to make sure that this bailout is implemented properly and that it isn't rife with abuse. And I think the inclusion of that in his first declaration as president-elect suggests to us that he understands how important it is to get that bailout, that rescue right. And, you know, again, I think the key here is that if it's not done right, if it's not fixed, if taxpayers aren't protected, a new president wants to build a great record. He's got a huge amount of political capital. I think he really does understand if that is not implemented properly, it will be like an anchor around his ankle, pulling his presidency down.
And David Sirota, clearly there is a timidity out there that in the opening, I quoted from your article, the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid just this week saying, in reference to the elections, this is not a mandate for a political party or an ideology. What explains that kind of timidity?
Well, I think it has to do with Democrats being afraid of the responsibility they now have. They asked for the responsibility. Now, all of a sudden, they have it. And there's a realization happening that, wow, we have this responsibility, and it's a huge amount of responsibility, and we will be judged on it. We no longer have a credible Republican Party, at least at this moment, that we can credibly blame inaction on. And I think that's scary to somebody like Harry Reid, who's in the driver's seat. And so the inclination, I think, is to essentially try to say that we can't do too much. And I think the real battle, where the rubber's really going to hit the road, is between the burgeoning progressive movement outside of the power structure, pushing that new power structure to go for bigger change, and a resistance among those inside of Washington who are going to say, you know, we're a little bit afraid here. And as I wrote in my column, you know, you've got this narrative set up that if Democrats reach too far, they will lose. And the narrative is that that's supposedly what Bill Clinton did when he came into office, that he supposedly tried to be too liberal, and he ended up paying for it by not only health care failing, but then losing the 1994 elections. Of course, that's revisionist history. What happened was that Bill Clinton came in and demoralized his base with leading with deficit reduction and the North American Free Trade Agreement, and then his demoralized base didn't turn out for the Democratic Party in 94. So this is a really, really important debate, and I think it will, if the Democrats do not go big, if they do not propose policies that are as big as the crises we face, the Republican Party will be back just as quickly as it seemed to collapse.
Well, I understand there is a tension within the party between the big donors, who are kind of Republican light in many ways, and the base. But the base is what got President-elect Obama elected, and he in a big part of his narrative was this outrageous 8 years of the transfer of wealth in this country to the 1%. It's worth reminding again that the 1% that Bush basically gave the government away to, they've tripled their income in the last decade, whereas the average American middle-class, working-class person, and remember, we exaggerate the extent to which we are a middle-class country. Over 50% of people in the United States earn less than $25,000 a year. That hardly puts them in the middle class. But wages have been flat since the 1970s, where while wages have been flat for the average American, the top 1% have tripled their income. That's on the surface a scandal, and I can't imagine why anybody would retreat from trying to reverse that.
Well, I think you're right. I think but I think you've answered your own. You've provided a rationale for your own question, which is that the donor class, their interest, the donor class is mostly from the top 5% of the country because they have disposable income to give so much money to campaigns. And that, by the way, that goes for Obama's campaign as well. He did raise a lot of small dollar donations, but the majority of his money is large checks. The donor class's economic interest is different from the economic interests of most people in the country. And so what we have is basically a politics in this country, or what we've had is a politics in this country that insists that we can have a country where the top 1% can make more than the bottom 50%, but at the same time we can solve that problem not by taking it out of the top 1%, but by simply moderately increasing what the bottom 50 or 90% make. In other words, it's this rising tide lifts all boats mantra that we've heard. What we've learned, I think, over the last couple of years is that we've changed the economy structurally to the point where as the economy, the macro economy does well, because, you know, before this recession, we were supposedly, at least at a macro level, in an economic boom. We've learned that we can have an economic boom that doesn't help ordinary people, that only helps those at the top. When you have rigged your tax laws and your trade laws and your regulatory laws in such a way, it can allow most of the profits of an economic boom to go up the income ladder. And so the question for Obama is, and I think he's starting to answer it, is can we have a new politics that actually fesses up to and is honest about the fact that in some ways this is an either-or binary zero-sum game, that at some level you have to say if you're going to help the middle class, you've got to ask for some sacrifice of those people at the very, very top of the income ladder. And I think Obama's tax plan actually inherently recognizes that. His talking point was this is a tax cut for the bottom 90% of the country. What he was implicitly saying was, I'm going to raise taxes on the top 5 or 10%. And the fact that he won while saying that, I think, represents a paradigm shift in our tax debate and in our debate over inequality.
Well, David, so just returning to the picture of the people lined up behind Barack Obama at his first press conference, a lot of captains of industry there, Pritzker, of course, Lawrence Summers, Parsons from Time Warner, and a number of industrialists, as well as the chairman of Google. I guess that's a new economy. But no people like Paul Krugman, Joe Stiglitz, Jeff Sachs, Jamie Galbraith, even George Soros, no hint of them. Robert Kuttner, who's been very prescient on all of this stuff. Again, what do you think is likely to be the makeup of his economic team?
Well, my guess is that it will be a mix, and that if you judge just ideologically on the people who are going to be in that mix, I would say that the mix will be establishment or mostly right of the establishment. You will have, however, I think, some progressive voices in there, arguably some more progressive voices than have ever been in the White House. I think you will have, you had up on that stage David Bonnier, who I think represents a far more progressive vision, far more than almost anybody who was up there, and almost anybody who's been in a top position in an administration. You also had Robert Reich, who was basically the progressive boundary of the Clinton administration. So I think that's good.
Locked in the cabinet. That's what he called his book, implying that he may have been a lonely voice in the Clinton cabinet.
He certainly was. And in the back of the room, there was Jared Bernstein, who was the very, very progressive economist. He was standing actually right next to David Axelrod, Obama's chief strategist. So I think you're going to get a mix. I mean, my issue here is what I hope is that beyond the ideological makeup of his economic team is the makeup of it in terms of its proximity to power in the past. And that's a long way of saying I hope to see, beyond just more progressive people, people who are new, people who have not been part of the old order. So when you mention Galbraith and when we talk about David Bonnier, these are two examples of people who really could represent fresh thinking. Austin Goolsbee, the University of Chicago economist, I mean, he's sort of an unorthodox economist. I know him. He's got some conservative views on some issues. He's got far more progressive views on other issues. He has not been part of that bipartisan ruling class in Washington, and I think it's that kind of new, bigger thinking from both sides that is actually arguably as important a question for Obama's team as the ideological makeup of it.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, David Sirota.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with David Sirota, who's a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist. His columns run weekly in the Denver Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Seattle Times. He's also the author of The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. I'm now speaking with Michael Lind, who is a Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. He is an author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and What Lincoln Believed, his groundbreaking study of American grand strategy, The American Way of Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy, and The American Way of Life, was published by Oxford University Press in October of 2006. He has a new article published at Salon.com suggesting that Barack Obama may join Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt on a short list of American presidents who presided over the refounding of the United States. And in Barack Obama's case, Michael Lind is suggesting that Barack Obama may bring about the Fourth Republic. So give us a sense of your historical divisions here of the country's history into three and then possibly a fourth republic?
Well, I think the idea of four republics, and it's purely metaphorical, formal republics, it's an interesting way to structure different stages in the country's evolution that goes beyond which party happens to be dominant at any given time, as important as that is. The First Republic lasted, in my estimation, from 1788 all the way up until 1860 with the Civil War. That broke down. The second one was dominated by manufacturing, first wave industrial industry. And the problems that caused led to the creation of the Third Republic under the New Deal and the Civil Rights Revolution. And in my interpretation, the conservative period of the last 30 years or so, 30 to 40 years, has been a backlash against both the New Deal and the Civil Rights Revolution, where they really didn't fundamentally change anything. They messed it up in some ways. But so the Third Republic, Roosevelt's New Deal Republic, I think was scheduled to expire in the last decade or so, and I think there are signs that it clearly has, which isn't to say you don't have a lot of continuity with the previous period. That was true. You know, there were 1920s holdouts in the 1960s and pre-Civil War mentalities all the way up until the end of the 19th century. But I think that quite apart from Obama's election, as historic as it is, there are signs that we've been moving from one period into another, which will build on the achievements of the past, but in many ways it will be quite novel and unexpected.
And Michael Lind, do you share David Sirota's notion that there's a pretty narrow window here, and already we've seen $700 billion go to Wall Street with apparently little results in terms of stimulating the economy? And although President-elect mentioned at his press conference that they're going to have to do some quick stimulus, the sense is that unless something starts happening soon, this whole thing could unravel.
Well, it may seem odd to say so, but I think if you want real fundamental change in Washington, there's going to be a prolonged and extremely painful window for two reasons. First of all, if you look at these financial crises in other countries like Japan and Sweden, Singapore, Hong Kong, it takes 5 or 10 years, even in good times, for the economy to dig its way out of it. So that means that if you don't do the right thing in the first 100 days, you will have a second chance in the second 100 days, in the fourth, and the fifth, and the 1,200 days. Now, it is very dangerous for a President-elect Obama and the Democrats in Congress, because if their methods don't work, they could be tossed out in favor of the Republicans. But on the other hand, the Republicans will be forced to experiment too, because their nostrums have already been tried and they've already failed. So I think we're in for a prolonged period, which could last up to a decade or a generation, of really struggling to redefine the national and the world economy, and that means that all of the ideas that people are going into now, liberal and as well as conservative, may be tested and found wanting.
But it's also true, is it not, that when a crisis begins, that if you don't make the right steps early, you can prolong the crisis, and that's clearly what happened with Hoover.
Well, arguably, it happened with Franklin Roosevelt. If he'd been a one-term president, he would be remembered as a failure now. Because associationalism and the NRA and a lot of the planning measures that he had supported in his first term, historians have said were miserable failures. They didn't make things worse than they'd been under Hoover, but they didn't solve the situation. And if we think of the achievements for which the New Deal is remembered, they largely came later. Social Security in 1935. Roosevelt wasn't even persuaded of Keynesian economic management until fairly late in his term. So I do think there's a danger that this first 100 days mythology means that now there's a political logic to it, which is driven by the presidential calendar. That is, you have your honeymoon initially. So if you want to call it the honeymoon period, it is very important for President-elect Obama to select the right priorities because his power will wane vis-a-vis the Democratic Congress itself after this initial honeymoon period. But in terms of public policies, I think we're going to have crisis after crisis for years to come, and each one of those will call for innovative solutions.
Well, you mentioned the analogy with the Japanese bubble bursting. Their economy was almost like the Sargasso Sea. It was almost like you're marooned in a windless wasteland in the middle of the ocean, and you can't move. And of course, the Swedish situation did take a number of years, and there are, I think, economic parallels there.
Well, Well, in some ways, if I may say so, our situation, as I see it, is the opposite of the Japanese situation and some of the others. Japan, like China today, is a producerist society. So is the Federal Republic of Germany, for that matter. Their problem has been that they favor their producers and exports too much, too heavily, that they save too much in both personal and national savings, and they invest too much in infrastructure. The United States and, to a lesser extent, Britain are the opposite problem. That is, we've been overly biased towards personal consumption, including consumption of housing, in depleting our savings. So that, you know, while we're in some ways where it's like the Japanese crisis, but in many ways, other ways, it's the exact opposite. The Japanese needed to grow out of their crisis, and they failed because Japanese consumers didn't consume enough and they saved too much. We're in the opposite situation. If we're going to grow our way out of this, it may be by adopting the technique that the Japanese tried and failed in that savings-heavy, consumption-low society, which is massive public investment in forced savings of some kind.
Well, it's not as if the investment's not necessary in infrastructure.
Well, it's necessary in any way, in the long run.
Yes, and it's hard to know exactly. I mean, there's so many bridges and roads that need to be fixed, but the broadband infrastructure needs to, the last mile thing is still, I mean, that seems to be our problem. And for example, we have some of the worst cell phone coverage in the world. I guess a lot of that's is you can put at the lap of the private entities, right?
Well, I don't think so, because if you look at, I blame the government mainly, particularly this conservative government that has starved public services like infrastructure of the necessary funds for a generation. If you look at the Reagan administration, the United States invested far more at the federal, state, and local level on infrastructure between the Eisenhower years and the Reagan administration, and then it dropped significantly. And the state and local share rose because the federal share declined. And so we're still in this post-Reagan sector of era of starving the public sector in order to pay for these tax cuts of the Reagan era and the Bush era. And I think the good news is that approach has been completely discredited now. Sooner or later, the Republicans will come back in one form or another, but I think that they will be part of a new consensus that's emerged.
So are you saying, Michael Lind, that we know that George W. Bush is all but irrelevant and I think pretty much in disgrace, but do you think some of that's going to rub off on the luster of Ronald Reagan?
Well, I think you're going to see a civil war within the Republican Party where the diehards insist, against all evidence, that the American people punish the Republican Party for being too in favor of big government by voting for big government Democrats in 2006 and again in 2008. And if that's their line, then it will be a marginalized Southern white reactionary party for years to come. On the other hand, I think that there will be a new kind of moderate republicanism, which is based not in Congress, but based in the states, and particularly among governors and mayors of big cities. And you see that to a certain extent already with Schwarzenegger. And either the Schwarzenegger party or the Tom DeLay party will prevail.
Well, the traditional moderate Republicans in the Northeast are all but extinct.
They're gone.
Yeah. So Michael Lind, this has echoes of your book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Policies. If you just looked at the map after the election, the Republican Party appears to have been reduced down to a Southern redoubt.
I think that's right. And I think the real story is you can parse the data any way you want it, but basically the Republicans gained as long as white Southern populist social conservatives were a swing vote added to their suburban base, which is basically what it was from Nixon, even through Reagan. Once the white Southern conservatives became the base, rather than simply swing voters, they so repelled the rest of the country with this very, and it's not conservatism as such. I mean, there's Northeastern conservatism. There's this very strange kind of Southern conservatism, which is rooted in the experiences of the Civil War and Reconstruction and segregation, that is just repugnant to many Republicans in other parts of the country. And I think that's the story. At the end of the day, the Republican Party just became the Dixiecrats, and it drove out not only independents, but a lot of Republicans who much preferred the older Eisenhower, Nixon, modern Republicanism into the Democratic Party, particularly in New England, but not exclusively there.
And Michael Lind, you lived this stuff pretty personally, did you not? You used to be William F. Buckley's editor. And you saw the, in fact, you warned about many, many years ago about the relationship that the Republican Party had with the evangelicals, almost like having a watchdog that you feed who's on a strong chain. But after a while, the dog grows to be so big that you don't necessarily control it.
Well, I was thinking back the other day. I was never a Buckley's editor, but I was a friend. And
I thought you worked on the National Review.
Oh, no, I just worked for him informally.
Oh, I see.
But I remember one time in the 1980s, he told me, because he was moderate by modern conservative standards. You know, he was Mr. Conservative. But the Today's Right would consider him suspiciously soft on the left.
Well, his son, you know, defected.
I think that wasn't as surprising as I'm not sure the father, you know, would have stayed with the party, except maybe just out of loyalty. But I remember he remarked to me at one point back in the 1980s, and he saw the change that was going on. He says, it appears that all of our readers live in Arkansas.
Well,
the original purpose of National Review, you know, and what Buckley and others did was they made conservatism acceptable to intellectuals and to people in the Northeast and the West Coast, or at least that was their mission. And he saw it sliding back into a kind of anti-intellectual, xenophobic, populist type of right, which had existed in the 40s and 50s.
Well, but the dichotomy now in the party, I think, is largely apparent over the issue of Sarah Palin, that people like Chris Buckley left because they were so appalled at this absolutely anti-intellectual disgrace who could become president of the United States. And yet the neoconservatives, who are the insurgents who seem to have taken over the Republican Party, certainly in terms of foreign policy, but remember, Bill Kristol is the guy that found Palin and basically started the drumbeat for her.
Yep.
I can't believe that these guys who pride themselves on having some intellectual connections to reality, although they've been consistently wrong, how and why do they continually defend this person? Is it because she's an empty vessel that they can fill up?
Oh, I think it's because they want jobs and influence. I mean, that's why many Democratic partisans, you know, are shamelessly in favor of anything the party does. I mean, there are hacks in both parties, let's face it. I think the real danger, though, is that you don't need intellectuals in the sense of professors, but you do need policy thinkers, you know, people who can master the complex machinery of the modern state and domestic and foreign policy and use it. And the neoconservatives, and to some extent the Buckley National Review conservatives, supplied those cadres, if you see my point. I don't see who are the cadres of, the intellectuals and the think tank experts and the people who can be appointed to high position of a Palinized party. Now, I fear from my own experience in politics in Texas that those positions are then simply filled by campaign contributors and by lobbyists. I mean, we saw that with Mr. Brown, you know, in the case of FEMA and Katrina. And my analysis of the Republican Party is they essentially lost their intelligentsia some years ago. And essentially you had a bunch of lobbies that wanted to plant their people in positions of policymaking authority to support their industries. And then they would appeal during the elections every 2 or 4 years to this kind of white, increasingly white Southern and Western populist base, which they simply manipulated to get into. My friend James K. Galbraith has written a book called The Predator State, brilliant book.
Yeah, yeah, I've interviewed him a number of times.
And his analysis is very similar to mine, that is, progressives are making a mistake when they're going after the theorists of the American Enterprise Institute and so on. What we've seen in the last decade or even longer than that, it's not been based on any kind of right-wing theory, be it libertarian or neoconservatism. It's just naked crony capitalism. It's just what you've often seen in many states. You have the statehouse gang and the special interests. And there's a total divorce between the actual agenda, once they're elected, and the various wedge issues they use to get elected. So my only warning there to progressives would be, don't fall into the trap of becoming bigots and sneering at the people that the right has manipulated. You know, those are decent people. The white working class is not just evil and vicious, no matter, even if they're fundamentalists. If you look at issues like gay rights and abortion, blacks and Latinos are far more homophobic. It just disturbs me when I see the attack on on Palin, which is perfectly legitimate, you know, because if you call your opponent socialist and terrorist, then you know, you've opened yourself up to criticism. But I think it's a terrible mistake if progressives turn this into an attack on white working class people in general, because at the end of the day, even if you can't get all of their votes, you want to get as many of their votes as possible.
Well, I've interviewed Joe Bagent, who's, I think, written a fairly interesting book in terms of why the Liberals have failed to reach out and to win this constituency who would normally be in their camp.
Well, Obama failed, you know, and generally I think he genuinely meant what he said in his comments about their, you know, to the rich San Francisco donors. When he thought he was speaking in private, and so he let slip what he really thinks of the white working class, that they're bitter and they cling to their guns and their religion and their hatred of people unlike them. He's got some real learning to do if he's going to be a spokesman, you know, for a party that is not simply a party of upper middle class professionals, you know, and ethnic minorities who are voting along ethnic lines, you know, rather than along class lines. He did worse than Kerry and Gore among the white working class in much of the country. The exception was in the Midwest, where he actually gained somewhat with the white working class in some areas, hit hard by the economy. But it's been a successful strategy. But the Democrats are now the majority party because they've become more suburban and more elitist than they were before the 2006 elections, mainly because of these New England, West Coast Rockefeller Republicans dumping the Republicans for the Democrats. And if you're going to be a party of the left or center left, that's kind of problematic, don't you think?
Well, I think so, and I don't know that how much comfort you can take in the difference in the popular vote between 52 million and 48. And obviously, the Electoral College strategy was brilliant, but I don't know at the end of the day that it says much more about the healing the kind of breaches that you're talking about. I mean, I guess to some extent, perhaps a lot of Democrats are saying, well, let the Republican Party become an irrelevant white Dixiecrat party. But you're saying that's a very short-sighted view.
Well, I just, you know, as an American, you know, when you had Republicans saying, well, screw the black vote, screw the Latino vote, we don't need them, we can build a lily white majority. Well, technically that's true if you're a narrow partisan. But if you want to have a flourishing, integrated society, that's not the attitude you should take. You know, so from the beginning, whether it makes sense strategically in the short run or not, I've always, you know, thought Howard Dean's 50-state strategy made sense. You're going to contest every state and every district because you want to represent everybody in the country. And they may vote against you, you know, but at least you'll make the effort.
So just in closing then, Michael Lynn, do you think that there will be a progressive agenda here? I mean, our first guest was suggesting that Obama essentially has a progressive mandate, but already Harry Reid is saying, no, we don't have this is nothing about ideology, you know. So they appear to be very shy of implementing it. I mean, obviously we've got an economy in such distress that I don't think any politician has the luxury of any kind of agenda until that's stabilized. But what's your reading on whether or not there will be a progressive agenda here?
Well, the progressive wing of the Democrats will, you know, very shortly become disillusioned with President Obama and probably Congress too, and denouncing them for not moving far enough fast enough. But I think you have to keep this in historical perspective. The conservative governments of the United States, at least if you look at the administrations, in many of the Western countries where you have center-right parliamentary regimes, have effectively nationalized banks in the last couple of months. You know, that whole Reagan, Thatcher, libertarian, free market fundamentalism is dead. It's dead. You will have a left and you will have a right in some sense. But wherever the center of gravity is on economic policymaking from now on, for the rest of our lives, I think, it will have shifted well to the left, even under conservative governments of where it has been the last 30 years. So in that sense, you know, progressives are never satisfied, but I think this is a big shift where it's not. And it was mainly events beyond the partisanship. It was the implosion of the world economy along with the national economy. But sometimes you have shifts where the pendulum swings back and forth from left to right. And sometimes you have these larger historic shifts, and that's what I was talking about in my Fourth Republic article, where the entire grandfather clock in an earthquake shifts, you know, 6 feet in one direction.
Well, we'll see, though. I think if the people that gave Barack Obama money and showed up to vote for him, if they were to move to Washington, and in this modern age that can be done in a virtual sense, if he had a lot of people at his back, then I think there'd be less of the inexorable Washington business as usual, the lobbyists taking over the agenda.
No, because even on Wall Street, from my context, you know, people are thinking things that were completely unthinkable before this entire financial crisis. And they're the ones who are thinking most out of the box. You know, people who would have been opposed to a progressive agenda in the past, talking about sovereign wealth funds and new regulation and all of this, because when you lose trillions of dollars in a few weeks, it kind of concentrates your mind.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Michael Lind.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Michael Lind, the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. And I'm now speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning journalist and videographer whose work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, The American Prospect, and Washington Monthly, and The Daily Beast, and other publications. He's a fellow at The Nation Institute and a senior fellow for Media Matters for America. His blog is maxblumenthal.com. And for the past 4 years, he has covered the right-wing political movements in America. His YouTube videos have received over 1 million hits. He has a new article on how the election of Barack Obama may energize the extreme right, and that article is available at The Daily Beast, Why White Supremacists Are Looking Forward to an Obama Administration. Max, there's been a couple of guys arrested. I think there was also earlier possibility of arresting some people up in Colorado, and I believe the Republican Attorney General decided to sit on that. There were also a number of reports throughout the Obama campaign of threats to him, which the campaign itself didn't want to make public because they didn't want to discourage people from voting for him. So just how much do you think Barack Obama is under threat?
Well, the easiest place to find this piece would be right now at my blog, which is maxblumenthal.com. And I don't have any way of gauging how much Barack Obama is under threat. But what I wrote is, or what I was able to report, is that there is a criminal subculture within the white supremacist movement that is hell-bent on doing some form of racial violence. These are, social misfits, sociopathic, adolescent, and you know, young men who are sort of shiftless and aimless, and this is the group that the demographic that generally commits hate crimes, senseless hate crimes, and they're influenced by the rhetoric of the organized faction of the white supremacist movement, which deplores this kind of violence because they see it as a terrible threat to their movement. It would bring the power of the federal government down on them, especially when there's the Patriot Act. The government has new law enforcement powers that could really destroy this movement. And they see Obama as a potential opportunity, just like the entire right wing does, just like the conservative movement. They see the Obama administration mobilizing resentment against that administration as an opportunity to fundraise and increase their organizational capacity. David Duke, who's trying to kind of renew his credibility after going into business with Suge Knight and then going to jail for bilking his donors. He wrote, "My bet is that whether Obama wins or loses in November, millions of European Americans will inevitably react with new awareness of their heritage and the need for them to defend and advance it." So Duke is sort of celebrating Obama's victory, and this is a classic right-wing strategy of mobilizing resentment for organizational gain. We saw them do it under Clinton, and we're going to see them do it again with Obama in the White House.
Well, there's an interesting denial that takes place amongst the right-wing propagandists, the powerful ones in this country, the Limbaughs, the Hannitys, and the O'Reillys. In many of these very, very public incidents where white loners have taken guns and shot people, there's an incident recently down in Tennessee, and as soon as the police show up in these people's houses to find out what made them tick, they find Hannity's and O'Reilly's and books and Limbaugh's CDs all over the place. Yet these people say they have nothing to do with it. So how much is already, this is a pretty poisonous campaign with Sarah Palin talking about making the division between real Americans and un-Americans, and Michelle Bachmann, the congresswoman, also made that pretty clear. How much do you think that kind of rhetoric from the Palin campaign has given permission for this kind of righteous rage?
Well, it's not. It's almost irrelevant. What I think, it's empirically provable that Palin's rhetoric increased the danger to Barack Obama's safety. The Secret Service reported that there was a dramatic uptick in threats to Barack Obama after the later Palin rallies, where she was, making these distinctions between real America and socialist America, and where she was accusing Barack Obama of palling around with terrorists. So she clearly played into this violent hatred that the right wing seems to feel for Barack Obama. Not only that, I reported for the Daily Beast on some of the characters who started showing up at Palin rallies to organize and leverage this hate for organizational gain. People like Randall Terry from Operation Rescue were at Palin rallies organizing. Randall Terry was the face of the terrorist wing of the anti-abortion movement in the 90s. The radio show Political Cesspool, I have video that I posted of them organizing at a Palin rally. This is the largest white supremacist radio show in the country, and the Southern Poverty Law Center calls it the largest nexus of hate in America. So they detected this hate and went to these rallies, not necessarily to support Sarah Palin, but to try to exploit that hate for their own causes. So I do think there's a danger. At the same time, there's also an uptick in gun sales right now. Is that because, racists want to assassinate Barack Obama? I don't think so. It's because they're being told by groups like the NRA and lesser groups and right-wing radio hosts that Barack Obama is going to take away their guns and institute new gun laws. So they want to get as many guns as possible. But this also plays into the mounting paranoia now that someone who has been called a socialist and even a terrorist has been elected president. So anything could happen, but I think what is absolutely going to happen is the right wing is going to raise a lot of money, and their membership roles of their organizations, from the NRA to the Heritage Foundation to the white supremacist groups, are going to increase.
It's clear that the kind of moral free ride that anti-abortion, the anti-abortion people have in terms of feeling this kind of moral zeal that others are killing babies, and that leads in a perverse kind of way to the logic of shooting abortion doctors. That's not exactly an epidemic, but it's a fact. Now, if the leader or the inheritor of the Republican Party, Sarah Palin, in an age when we are in what Bush and Cheney call the war on terror, if in the context of a war on terror, you say that the Democratic leader and now the president-elect pals around with terrorists, that is more or less saying an accusation of treason, isn't it?
It opens the door for what my friend David Nywert calls eliminationism, which is the idea that the enemy is so subhuman that they have to be eliminated by any means. And that's why the Secret Service detected this uptick of threats against Barack Obama. I don't think that any of these threats will be realized. But what I do think is, during the Clinton years, this anti-abortion movement sought to undermine. They felt like they were out of power, and they wanted to undermine the tenets of secular society. And in order to do that, they attacked abortion clinics and symbols of what they saw. Symbols of Bill Clinton's perceived liberalism and the Democrats' perceived liberalism. So abortion clinics and, gay bars. Eric Rudolph bombed gay bars, and that's more likely what we're going to see is an uptick in domestic terrorism, but not necessarily attacks on Barack Obama. And it's really hard to trace it back to someone like Rush Limbaugh, but Rush Limbaugh's been on the radio stoking economic anxiety in a way that I haven't heard before. He's referred to the economic doldrums as the Obama recession, blaming Obama for the economy. And so that's what they're going to do. They're going to blame Obama for everything. And who knows how people will react. But I find it troubling. And you know, I can't accuse Rush Limbaugh of cultivating people for violence. What I can say he's doing is, you know, trying to increase membership roles of right-wing organizations and raise funds, but that has untold consequences, as we saw from the threat that I wrote about against Barack Obama by these two, you know, white supremacist sociopaths from Tennessee who were influenced by, you know, the white nationalist rhetoric of people who deplore threats against Barack Obama, but also use rhetoric that invites those threats.
Max Blumenthal, obviously the proliferation of firearms makes all of this these concerns much more real, in as much as people have such ready access to weaponry that they can actually employ their violent fantasies. I mean, we've had some amazing examples of the insanity of the gun culture just in the last few days. An 8-year-old boy shot his father and another adult with a gun that his father had bought him, feeling that an 8-year-old needed to know how to use weapons. And then just a few weeks ago, I think a 13 or 12-year-old, his father took him out to a gun club, gun show, where you could fire an Uzi, and they gave the kid an Uzi, and he couldn't control it, and it you know, slipped out of his hands, and you know, they rise up when you fire them, so almost, you know, shot him in the head and killed him. So, I mean, it's,
you know, I really think that the battle for gun control, or the battle over gun rights, has been decisively won by the NRA and groups like that. And it's because, you know, people, because there's a divide in the cities and in the country for how people use guns. When I went to Alaska, the first thing people asked me, including liberals, was, you know, are you in favor of taking our guns away? And I said, no, I mean, it's just, you know, where I grew up, there were drive-by shootings, and so we want gun control in the cities. And they said, well, we need guns to protect ourselves against bears out here. So, I mean, it's just a really potent issue for organizing in rural areas, even among Democrats. And Barack Obama's evolution on that issue really shows the defeat of gun control advocates. Here's a guy who, when he was running for the state Senate in Chicago, said he favored a handgun ban, which is pretty plausible in the south side of Chicago. But not when he started running for president, he endorsed a Supreme Court decision overturning D.C.'s handgun ban, you know, which was a very, you know...
Right. No, I think in practical terms, I think it's a lost battle, at least, and that's certainly the way the Democrats look at it. Just in closing, Max Blumenthal, since you did do some of the best coverage of Palin's Alaska in terms of digging up her relationship with Bishop Mute, the exorciser of witches, etc. I don't know whether you're following up on it, but it looks as though, you know, there was so much an expectation of theft in this election that people were, the Cassandras were warning us that the election was going to be stolen and stolen and stolen. And, well, it turned out that it wasn't quite that bad, except in Georgia and in Alaska. There's a real evidence that fewer people voted, according to their statistics, in this election than they did for Kerry. And yet there was record registration. So on the surface, something really smells bad up there.
That's common in Alaska, especially because it's hard to count votes in the bush, which is, you know, areas that aren't accessible by roads and or by you know, any form of transportation. It's also hard to poll out there. But I can't really speak to that. I haven't been covering that. But what I'm following is this sort of fallout from Palin's failure, where McCain's people are dumping all this information on her. And, you know, no one's been more critical of Sarah Palin than me. But I really feel sorry for her right now. The McCain campaign, you know, she didn't seek this nomination, and the McCain campaign's now blaming all their failures on her, proving that they really don't put country first. You know, she was going to be
right. Well, I tried to get Kyle Cameron on today, the Fox News, a political correspondent who, fed that story by the McCain people. But needless to say, surprise, surprise, he didn't want to go on.
Well, what this shows is it reflects just as much about the McCain campaign as it does about the media. You know, the media would rather focus on whether Sarah Palin came out into a meeting before the Republican convention in a towel than how her extreme ideology contributed to McCain's defeat and his failure to win over independent voters. They don't want to talk about politics or ideology. They want to talk about fluff and pseudo-scandals. And that's what this is all about. Sorry for Sarah Palin. And it's troubling because someone like Bobby Jindal, who's actually competent, who's actually intelligent, the governor of Louisiana, but is just as extreme, if not more extreme than Sarah Palin, this is a guy who claimed he performed an exorcism in college, could easily win over the media because they don't want to look at ideology or politics.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Max Blumenthal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Marshall. Just speaking there with Max Blumenthal, award-winning journalist and videographer. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Tamika Zogi, the engineer. Bye. Thank you.